Welcome, welcome to the Katie Speaks Show, streaming here on Netroots Radio every Saturday and Monday. You can get the podcast for free wherever pods are cast and subscribe at patreon.com/Katie_speak to support the show and get bonus content as well as early access to episodes. You can also make a crucial one-time contribution at paypal.me/KatieSpeak_. I'm your host, Katie Klebusik. Find me on Twitter and across social media at Katie_speak. Info for guests and links to topics can be found in the episode notes at katiespeak.com, along with other ways to support and engage with the show. Content note, guests and I discuss sensitive and explicit topics on the show. Those with triggers should listen with care. Hi, y'all. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad we're here. We've made it through another week. Congratulations. Definitely adopted the congratulating myself for every small victory during these here ridiculously heavy feeling times, and I highly recommend it. In today's show, at long last, and long overdue, I have Imran Siddiqui back on the show to talk about, what else? Toxic masculinity and, some of its manifestations and how it affects all of us, including you all, male-identified folks. It definitely affects you negatively and people of all genders negatively. And so it's never an outdated topic. It's a brief pause in the Abortion Deep Dive series as the fantastic Jill Adams continues to have to travel. And we are working on syncing our schedules. Also coming up, it is officially Supreme Court decision season. I can't believe it snuck up on me. What happened to May? I don't even know. So I am wrangling a couple of legal experts. This has become kind of the year of lawyers on this show. Probably could have anticipated that considering the fuckery of the administration for a lot of marginalized folks during this administration. Having legal advocates tirelessly and often at great expense to themselves offering and working on the only remedies that there are when you have a federal administration that is this hostile to, well, human rights and basic elements of dignity. So with that as a backdrop, I promise Imran and I don't directly discuss the president very much. So if he is one of your hard to listen to topics, I think we mentioned him once or twice. Full disclosure, we recorded the interview a few weeks ago, and I don't remember every single minute of it. So it's possible there's more than a passing reference, but not really. We're really more talking about the phenomenon in general that definitely manifests itself in a way that has given us this administration. I don't like to just limit it to the president, especially because of my intense, intense disdain for Mike Pence. And so there will be Supreme Court discussions coming, and as always, they may not be in the breaking news style. It's not really what we do on this show, but I will definitely have people on to discuss the impact of decisions. So, as always, taking you past the headlines and doing more explanation and discussion of things. This week's show is another one of those where the guest and I went overtime because we can, because podcast formatting allows me to do that. So if you're listening to this as it streams, on your drive home or, while you're getting some work done around the house on Netroots Radio, and you're into it, the full conversation, the full episode is available for free on all of the podcast streams, highly recommend tossing in at least a dollar at patreon.com/Katie_speak. Then you can get the show early. You can get the show in full. It's got a really handy, very visible RSS feed link for you to enter into your podcast streamer catcher device app on your phone, iPad, computer, Android device, whatever you're listening to this show on. And so before we get to the chat with Imran, I wanted to bring y'all a little bit of this book I've been reading. I do a fair amount of reading for this show. I know that there's a lot of information and analysis and knowledge out there that people with regular jobs do not have time to go through. And so it's one of the, I think of it really as a service that I do for listeners. I very regularly, particularly in the bonus episodes, talk about what I've been reading and make recommendations, but also give little snippets also of what I've been listening to, which recently is the fantastic podcast by the folks in Chicago, WBAS. I'm going to get the station wrong. I'm so sorry. It's attached to the Chicago Tribune. The podcast is titled 16 Shots. It's about the Laquan McDonald execution by Chicago police a few years ago and how the public found out about it, the reactions, the responses. It's very victim-centric, as in it is not focused on the police officer's story. It is focused on how Laquan McDonald exemplifies decades and decades and decades and decades of, in the case of the Chicago Police Department, torture. That is not an exaggerated term. Torture was not just sanctioned by the Chicago Police Department. It was regularly required and carried out by leadership for a couple of decades. And lawsuits have put all of that in the open and made it very clear that going back to Mayor Daley's directive that he made in public on air, that Chicago police should shoot to kill anyone who seemed like a problem, basically. And so I understand that that is, because there are over 30 episodes, it's both time intensive to listen to and for some folks, just too much to listen to. And so I'm pulling some really important snippets and stuff from there and sharing some of that with listeners on the bonus feed. So highly recommend you can get all that content for a dollar a month. How about that? So as a lead into my discussion with Imran, I have been reading a book with an intentionally eye-catching title. In fact, I took it with me to New York in case I needed to read it on the plane or on a train to make sure I was left alone, because the cover title is Dead Girls. The subtitle being Essays on Surviving an American Obsession. And it's one I admit to being pretty obsessed with myself. I'll talk about this more in the bonus episode I do on this book, but my particular trauma and childhood history has always left me very intrigued by human behavior in a way where I regularly feel like an observer, even though it's, I mean, pretty sure I'm human. My 23andMe came back with no conclusive evidence to the contrary. So, I definitely have made a kind of a lifelong habit of reading books about, watching shows about, listening to podcasts about deviant behavior. Everything from serial killers to, you know, stories of surviving incredible abuse and trauma, things like that. And even well knowing like how problematic it is that there's like an entire industry that makes its money off of dead girls. And so I was really interested in reading a very thoughtful, thorough analysis of this phenomenon, particularly by somebody who, like me, has always been pretty into the noir genre and also just the cultural phenomenon that make it possible for there to be enough dead girls from true crime stories, let alone fiction, for there to even be a prolific genre of these things, right? You couldn't create a couple of dozen television series to air at a time on this topic if there wasn't just a dearth of information out there on it. And one of the things that Alice Bolan, the author, does is kind of dissect some of that background. So I want to read you just the end of her introduction, because I really, really recommend this book, and I'm also sort of hoping you'll toss in for the bonus episode so you can hear more about it. Okay. She writes, there's a cliche in true crime TV that, quote, the husband did it, and viewers yawn their way through episodes where men murder their wives for insurance money and then call 911 sobbing. It turns out the husband did it in cases of mass murder, too. According to a statistic cited in the New York Times, in 56% of mass shootings from 09 to 15, a spouse, former spouse, or other family member were among the victims. Domestic violence is one of the strongest indicators of future mass violence, and their dynamics of control are so similar that some experts call it intimate terrorism. Our refusal to address warning signs that are so common they have become cliché means that we are not failing to prevent violence, but choosing not to. Hamilton's case seems like a baffling collective refusal to see what he was capable of. 3 months before the shooting, he told the doctor that he planned to use a bomb or shoot people. 6 days before, he told his tattoo artist that he was going to shoot people out of the bell tower, but the tattoo artist said, I thought nothing of it because he jokes about crazy ass shit. Judge Stegner said that he, quote, seemed like the all-American young man. Collective groan. And even though they set up a mental health court in the county after the shooting, he worried that Hamilton would not have been diverted to it. At some point, we choose to believe our idea of, quote, the all-American young man over flags as red as blood. One commonality of domestic abusers and mass killers is a sense of grievance. Pausing the quote, this part, just like every other page in this book, I just stop and think about what she wrote and just like let it simmer a little bit. And this is one of those spots. One commonality of domestic abusers and mass killers is a sense of grievance, a belief that someone somewhere had wronged them in a way that merited a violent response, as Amanda Taub wrote in the New York Times after the Pulse nightclub shooting. Violent men's grievances are born out of a conviction of their personal righteousness and innocence. They are never the instigators. They are only writing what has been done to them. This shit-eating innocence is crucial to the fantasy of American masculinity, a bizarre collection of expectations and tropes so paralytically infantile, as James Baldwin writes in Freaks and the American Ideal of Manhood, that it is virtually forbidden as an unpatriotic act that the American boy evolve into the complexity of manhood. Whew. American boys have trampled most of our popular stories. In his 1949 essay, A Question of Innocence, Baldwin writes a scathing assessment of the noir where the woman, quote, is the incarnation of sexual evil, but the man, for all his Tommy guns and rhetoric, is the innocent, inexplicably, compulsively, and perpetually betrayed. The truest love of any noir protagonist is, of course, never the femme fatale, for, quote, the boy cannot know a woman since he has never become a man. James Baldwin, y'all. American boys in their grievance and longing invented their dream girl, the dead girl. My interest in the boy heroes of Twin Peaks and Raymond Chandler spawned the first essays for this book, which began as an exploration of the noir mysteries of the American West and ended up as something more like a survival guide as the violence I studied hit ever closer to me. Like other writers before me, I've tried to make something about women from stories that were always and only about men. Whew. And that is the perfect segue to my chat with Imran. Someday they're gonna wanna know me for who I am. Filmmaker, writer, speaker, and activist challenging the representation of race and gender in popular media, in addition to being the current communications director at the Center for Media Justice and a founding staff member of the Representation Project. They are a member of the Philadelphia South Asian Collective and a collaborator with the South Asian American Digital Archive. In all their spare time, they've been published at The Atlantic, BuzzFeed, Longread, Salon, Bitch, and The Week, curates and publishes content at patreon.com/ImranSiddiqui, where you should totally become a subscriber, and tweets at the same handle. My goodness, I definitely missed a thing or two, but I am out of breath, so Imran, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm also out of breath listening to you say that. But yeah, no, it's great to be here, and it's been too long, and you know, I'm glad to be here though. And how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for asking. That is lovely. At risk of breaking the fourth wall, third wall. I don't know. We're in 2D. What is the wall? This is the second time recording this intro because I had a tech failure. Isn't tech great, everyone? It's the best and also so awful. So we were just chatting about how you got to go on vacation and accidentally had to take it easy.
Yes, I was in Greece and I sprained my ankle on the way there. I don't really know how. I also feel like it's just, you know, a sign of getting older or something. Like you just walk around and sprain your ankle, you know.
Or bruise your shins on furniture you've had for years. Just me? Is it just me?
Oh, exactly. And so, you know, yeah, as a result, I was saying, you know, I typically have like, well, I did have itineraries of like everything I wanted to do during this vacation every day. But having that injury kind of forced me to actually embrace a slower pace, relax, read a book. And turned out to be really nice. And it was a beautiful time of year to be there. So, yeah, I'm grateful that I had that opportunity.
Yeah, we all need to take the occasional day off or weekend or staycation or whatever it should be. It's one of my favorite things about having moved to San Diego is the expectation of quality of life here is very different than the Midwest where I'm from, where I often describe the Midwestern work ethic as this very bizarre work yourself to literal death just for the sake of working. Why aren't you working? Why are you off? You work. I work uphill both ways. It's a thing. You just do it. It has been the hardest thing to explain to my California-based therapist.
I'll tell you, I grew up in Illinois, so also a Midwesterner.
It's hard not to absorb it when you're around it all the time. So being in a place where if I say I worked a 12-hour day instead of hearing, well, I worked a 16-hour day, I get a surprised look and why? It's very helpful being reminded to go to the beach. So we're going to talk a lot about gender-based violence today, an unfortunately routine part of specializing in patriarchy and racial justice and their intersections. So I thought we'd start with the term itself for listeners, some of whom may only picture like an abusive hetero marriage domestic situation when they hear it. So for you, what does gender-based violence encompass?
Yeah, you know, at its most basic level, it's, of course, you know, violence directed at a person because of their gender or rooted in a perception of their gender or, you know, things like that. But, it, you know, for me, when we talk about gender-based violence, it's always within from a systemic approach. So within a system of patriarchy, which, you know, is how we are socialized also to think about you know, people who are perceived to be cis men, to be dominant over everyone else. And so at its root, you know, like patriarchy is violent already, you know, whether there's physical violence or not physical violence, there are other ways in which we are always in kind of a gender-based system of violence, you know, and it particularly does impact people who are not seen as dominant. So that would be, you know, women, but not only women, you know, people of other genders who are, you know, marginalized. And and so the violence that I think about is not just the physical violence, but the violence of existing in a system of patriarchy. And then on top of that, particularly, you know, it's a white supremacist system of patriarchy that's also capitalist and imperialist and all those things. And so certain people are feeling that violence more in greater ways.
Yes, the more marginalized identity boxes that you check, the more compounding the violence. I am going to borrow a definition from the Asian Pacific Institute on Gender-Based Violence, who takes their definition from the United Nations, which is not the ultimate authority on everything there is, but we're going to use it for very specific reason. The United Nations defines gender-based violence as any act that results in or is likely to result in physical, sexual, or psychological harm or suffering to women, including threats of such acts, coercion, and arbitrary deprivations of liberty, whether occurring in public or private life. And then, of course, the Asian Pacific Institute adds on, you know, gender-based violence is largely male pattern violence and can include the victimization of women, girls, men, boys, adolescents, lesbian, gay, transgender, and gender non-conforming people. So, of course, they make it more intersectional. There's been a fair amount of publicity about Trump getting rape essentially downgraded at the international level. Aside from the obvious ramifications for survivors of that particular type of gender-based violence, the perpetual focus on not just rape, but the strikingly rare circumstances of stranger rape, because that's always the picture that's being called upon when folks like our president talk about it. It frustrates me as a survivor of multiple kinds of violence and abuse. So who gets left out when we zero in on this one act?
Yeah, I mean, so many people. I mean, because as I was alluding to, you know, like so much of our, you know, society is built around a type of violence, and often, you know, all of it is really gender-based violence. I mean, so many different things are left out. But also, even if we're talking about sexual violence, and the different types of sexual violence, you know, by, you know, it's actually a tactic across the board for maintaining systems of power, is to pick an extreme act in order to portray everyone else who's not in that extreme as a good person, or as a, you know, as okay or all right, you know. And I, you know, for someone, I talk about masculinity a lot, and I think about how, you know, by defining bad masculinity, it's always the intent there is often to portray ourselves as good men, you know, or good masculinity. So in a similar way, by focusing on rape, as the only or the most, or the only, important act of sexual violence, so many other types of sexual violence is ignored, and then thus the survivors of that are minimized, or as we've seen, you know, in the last few years with the Me Too movement, you know, when people bring up allegations like of like sexual, what, you know, there's all these weird terms in the press for like, you know, categories of sexual violence, and
feel,
I don't
free,
know
what feel they, free to hate on the press all you
yeah
like.
I don't really well, I don't really know what they mean, but like, you know, there's different words for different euphemisms for different types of things. But point is, you know, if someone says like, I was on a date, like, I'm thinking about that Aziz Ansari story from a few years ago, when, you know, and people kind of dismiss something like that, you know, where he's accused of really, you know, kind of ignoring consent, and whether or not he, you know, acted, you know, in a way that we read as rape, you know, by creating this environment in which someone has to explicitly, openly rape someone in a way. And by that, I mean, like, they have to physically violate them, you know, in a, like, you know, in a penetrative way, basically, for us to consider it rape, you know, by creating that environment.
Preferably then, with bruises and torn clothing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And like, and we can even talk about the standard and how it, there isn't even really a standard there, but, you know, but by creating that environment, then, you know, we saw what happened with that story is like, you know, it's like people, and regardless of how well written it was or not, it's like people end up focusing on the person who was hurt, you know, and discrediting them. You know, the story becomes whether they are believable or not, and all these different ways in which we're moving away from actually fixing the problem of rape culture, which is, you know, this entire culture in which it's kind of what we're talking about. It's like the culture of allowing this to persist. If we really wanted to end the extreme acts of sexual violence, then we'd have to be willing to talk about the whole culture. But that's not actually what ends up happening. And yeah, and on that point, it's like, even if someone actually did, by our acceptable, even Donald Trump's standard of what rape is, even then, if, you know, even if you get it on video, there's, you don't have any guarantee that anyone will believe you, or that it will be presented in the way that is, you know, honest, you know. So I think that, but that is the tactic, by getting us to challenge our thinking about, you know, getting us to focus on this idea of like, this counts as rape and this doesn't, we actually, it's a way of distracting us from actually working on challenging culture.
Yeah, like the idea that if it's not prosecutable, that it's not bad behavior, right? That was the thing about that case from last year, that like, she wasn't, and the survivor, the girl who wrote about it, like, she, I don't remember anywhere in there that she was calling for him to be arrested, or even for him to lose his, all the things that are like, well, we don't know for sure, and we can't, like, no, like, the point is that we have all of us been in some sort of date or date-like situation that kind of went back and forth like that. Because, spoiler, consent can be given and taken away and needs to be continually, given. And that means that we've all been in a situation where we might have been into it at some point, but then the assumption, that's what always does it for me. Even less the, like, even less the pushing for something, but the assumption that you just presumed that without us talking about it, that of course we were going to be engaging in XYZ, even though we hadn't discussed it. That in a second, like, that's it. Like, desire turned off.
Yes.
And I'm out. Like, and I have actually gotten up and left, like, multiple times when that has been the case. And, like, you know, if somebody pushes two or three or four, or like, at what point where you're saying, come on, like, come on, come on, like, where you're trying to convince, do we stop using the word convince and use the word coerce, right?
Yeah.
And as long as all of that middle part between full consent and the unfortunately acceptable, like, standard of violation occur, as long as that entire gray middle is, like, allowable, acceptable behavior, not to mention are a bunch of people experiencing awful, possibly traumatic things, but also plenty of the people at the extreme are going to sneak by because we've set the standard so close to the extreme that now it becomes just an impossible bar to leap.
Yeah. And I think two points that come to mind about that is that, one, you know, the reason that I think it's so important to talk about gender-based violence from a systemic point of view is that, you know, there's an assumption often coming from straight cis men, but from a lot of people who talk about it, is that there's a myth of neutrality in a situation, you know, that, like, oh, well, we're on a date, you know, and particularly, like, if it's a heteronormative situation and you're like, oh, I'm a woman and you're a man, you know, the assumption from those in power is often, oh, it's a neutral, you know, situation. Now I need to figure out whether they're giving me consent or not. But, you know, a key point of the systemic approach is to realize that it's never neutral. So you come into that room with power, and that power makes it imbalanced. And so it's not simply a matter of, like, we had a disagreement, or I thought she said this and, you know, but she didn't. It's an understanding that people in power have to bring ahead of time that it's not neutral. And I think that's always lacking. And then it's always, like, in retrospect, it's like trying to figure out what happened. And then that part, the part where we, in retrospect, then the standard is always, let's litigate it, or let's make it like a legal thing. But that's assuming then that the system of, you know, the legal system is neutral, you know, which we again know is not. And in fact, is a system of violence. And in fact, is a system which is built to protect those in power who are, you know, like, white and men, and is a system in which tons of gender-based violence happens and is state sanctioned. And so saying something is legal or illegal, or, you know, that's not a good defense, but you see, like, yeah, that's how those two things work together. It's like, A, let me pretend like I think that there's neutrality because the world is supposedly ever a neutral place. And then B, when I get called out on, I violated somebody's consent, let me lean on this other system, pretend it's neutral, but knowing that it's going to protect me. So that's really what we see over and over again with when people are accused of gender-based violence.
Yeah, and boy, is that an awful standard. yeah, for sure. I really like that, the myth of neutrality. And yeah, I mean, almost no situation is neutral. There is just so very few, you know, like, you maybe at the coffee shop across the table from each other where you arrived separately and can leave separately, right? That may be, like, that's the last moment in any kind of engagement that's even neutral. So all of this has kind of been a bit of a precursor to Joe Biden. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on the primary. especially not 10 months from the first one. God help us all. I'm not endorsing anyone publicly anyway, because my beat is usually breaking down policy and sometimes the tone of the race. And I don't want my, like, personal opinion on who I'm going to vote for to like weigh in too hard on that. But I am going to put you on the spot just a little because I know you have feelings about Uncle Joe's gendered violence record. So feel free to tangent and harken back as far as you like. But I thought we'd start with It's On Us. That was from your Twitter feed. Your tweets from a couple weeks ago. It's pretty clear you aren't a fan of that framework. So explain a bit about what makes it problematic for you.
Well, you know, and I think it's for Joe Biden, there's so many different things. We could start with like Anita Hill. It's the first thing I think about whenever I think about Joe Biden, which I think is good. I think we should always think about Anita Hill because, you know, Joe Biden's response to that hearing or the way he was in charge of it and the way he managed it was so indicative, I think, of his approach at that time. And I would say his approach has changed over time, but has not necessarily gotten to a point which centers survivors and particularly which centers, you know, women or the people he often is given credit for centering or himself says that he centers. And a great example of that is the It's On Us campaign, because for me, I remember being asked to speak at an event once that was about It's On Us, and I heard Biden speak at that event, I've heard him talk about it throughout the time of the campaign. And the thing about It's On Us is by its nature, it's saying that the task of solving gender-based violence, of changing rape culture, is on us. And the us in this case is men. It's really the implication is it's straight cis men. And while on the surface, that sounds like the right idea in the sense that like, okay, those people who are in power should be working on dismantling their system of power. In practice, so often I found that the way that Biden approaches it, many people on that, and I don't want to hate on the campaign overall for It's On Us because a lot of awesome people worked on it. And I think it did awesome stuff on campuses, and there's a whole nother, the impact of the people who organized around it is independent of the campaign mm-hmm. framing itself. But the framing then often came back to let's keep talking about men. So, and that's what often happens, I think, when like men come into conversations about gender-based violence, it's like they might have been called in most often, almost 100% of the time, they're called in by a person of another gender, you know, or were led there, you know, inspired, like myself included, you know, like read a bell hooks book and I want to be a part of this. But then when you're there, you know, so often a lot of the leaders there are straight cis men, often white. And they're often saying it's on us, but what they mean is let's keep talking about us.
Right.
And the conversation.
It could just be like at its base, when I first heard the name, I was like, oh, like possibly this means that like if straight cis dudes are the majority, though not all, the majorities of the perpetrators in this system, then that means that the only like if you want to stop rape, you have to like rapists
yeah,
have
stop
to stop
doing it. Yeah.
Right. And so like in my head, part of me was like, oh well, okay, like maybe this is an accountability move, which would not be the only thing we'd need, but might be a nice component. Like a nice add-on to like the overall work. But if it really in practice just turns out to be a reason to make it about them instead of on them.
Yeah, and I should say, you know, and again, I'm not saying that's how it happened everywhere across the whole, this is a national campaign and Joe Biden just, you know, one guy who's talking about it. He was like a figurehead of it, but like more in the way that he's talked about it. And I think it connects back to how he's responded recently to people who are, you know, accusing him or alleging that he touched them improperly or that he was super creepy or maybe potentially, you know, I don't know if anyone's accused him of assault, but like in general, just that he's improper touch, you know, and the way that he's responded to that has to me indicated of gone back and hearkened back to how you would talk about the campaign It's on Us, because it takes no personal, it does not take a systemic approach. It assumes a neutral ground of like, you know, I'm just a person who wants to support you. So I smelled your hair before you, you know, whatever you did, you know, and before you went on as a way to give you encouragement. And again, the thing that where that Joe Biden's argument gets stuck is ever getting to a place where it's actually on you, you know, like it's actually on us. So like, because Biden very easily could have responded to those stories and said, you know, yeah, as a straight cis white man in power, you know, who's been in power for decades, the fact that I still don't know how to interact with women in public, and I make many of them uncomfortable with my, you know, physical behavior, that's on me to, you know, think about and change, you know. And instead,
right, he could have even shared, he could have totally shared blame for that, or like taken, like acknowledged the behavior and affirmed the feelings and impressions of the, even if he wanted to invoke something like the myth of neutrality, right? Where like, even if in his mind, like we were just two people talking or two people posing for a picture or something, and this is, you know, it's, that's so entrenched, like even somebody who spent decades working on it, like me, right? I mean, he's a politician. Like he should have been able, that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it with you, is that like, if somebody who is as quick as Biden, of our elected officials with national prominence in the last, you know, couple of decades, he's certainly one of the most like memeable. There's a mm-hmm. reason why we all liked the Obama and Biden memes, even if we didn't love them. You know, if he couldn't find a way to like spin that in the moment in a way that like both took accountability and then put most of the blame on the systems of power and then thrown some sort of slam at Trump, right? Like, it just seems like, for me, in my brain, like, that's such an easy A to B to C, like, move, that it really does exactly what you were saying, that, like, it didn't occur to him to be able to quick spin it that way, really shows how, just how much, really the real experiences of people with less power and of a different gender than him, like really live with every day.
Yeah. And I think that the thing about Trump is such a, it's a good example of where folks get stuck, because the approach to critiquing Trump's open misogyny and like known violence, really actually being, you know, abusive towards women, self-admitted, you know, right? We know that he did that. The way that white men in power have approached critiquing that behavior is so often been, Trump is bad, I am good, you know, and Biden gets stuck there. And so even, like you said, the transition should be quite easy to go from, this happens, you know, I take accountability for this, but I'm not Trump. Even that framing, which is still a little bit like mm-hmm. the good guy, bad guy thing, it's hard for men in power to go there, because, you know, really the leverage against Trump, the main argument is simply that, you know, he's like an evil person. He's like another type of person, like not even...
Right.
People don't want to put themselves in the same category, but that's the key, is like, if you don't, you know, that's why I get, it really bothers me, the approach that Biden and others like him, like I would, you know, my least favorite, maybe public figures like Bill Maher, but like,
he's, you know, the least favorite of just about everyone here. Hello, everyone listening. If you still watch his show, he's just awful. Stop it. Okay.
But like, yeah, it's a very like, you know, I'm good and everyone else is bad. But like, you have to keep framing it like that, to convince yourself of that. But that means that in the moment where you're asked to be accountable or called in, you're going to have a lot of difficulty. And we all struggle with and are not good at being accountable. You know, like that's a hard thing to do. But I just think that I guess what I'm saying is not, I don't want to talk about politics in the campaign too much, but I don't think like Biden versus Trump is such an easy win for the Democrats because Biden would be unwilling to actually, you know, include himself in that conversation about gendered violence. And one thing that Trump actually does a lot is he picks up on men's inability to admit that they also do the things that all men do. And because he knows that, he'll often, you know, trick someone into coming out and admitting that they're that person too, or accidentally, you know, showing some behavior that shows us, you know, and from the beginning, we can all kind of just say, yes, we're all part of the system of gender-based violence. And I don't know, I mean, that's probably asking a lot of our current people in power, but I'm waiting for the day that one of our candidates who identifies as a man is able to start the conversation there and then go into it. And maybe some people can. I haven't really paid attention to everybody's.
Yeah, just if we could just get a pivot. If you could at least, if we could start with a pivot, right? We're not going to take a hard left turn all at once, but a pivot would be nice. Your second tweet in the series from earlier in April really, like, particularly hit me. It was part of why I wanted to talk about it. So the only solutions to rape culture, sexism, patriarchy that men like Biden will celebrate are those that maintain a distinction between good and bad men, as you were describing, not only because they want to be seen as good, but because they know this actually reinforces their masculinity and power over others. Woo! That's really, yeah. I mean, probably even harder to admit to themselves than I might have made someone uncomfortable is like wielding the kind of power that can make someone uncomfortable.
Well, like if you think about Biden again, you know what he, you know, and I was right there with the memes during the Obama era too.
Sure.
And like, but like if you think about what that was really about, it's like cool Joe or good old Joe or whatever. It's very much still very much a masculine ideal. Like he's our, you know, if you think about like our, if he's your, I don't know, nice uncle or whatever, I don't know what people used to call him, but like
the cool, funny uncle. I had one of those. Exactly. Mine was my uncle Jim, right?
So if Biden plays that role for America and he embraced it, like he was always into it. And in his new campaign, he's still, you know, I saw some of their merch still going that route with him in the sunglasses. But what that's really, it's one example of how all that talk about, you know, gender equity or however he approaches it from different angles. And he has talked about it, which, you know, other people don't do, but he has talked about it. But it's never in a way that would ever challenge his perception to other men that he's a real man. And so when he talks about It's On Us, and when I heard him speak way back, it was like that. It was like, hey, man, be a man and don't hurt women. And that framing of like that your manhood is, it's still a competition of proving your manhood. And like if it's never going to work, if you're going to try to convince men to not hurt people of other genders by saying this makes you a real man, that's never going to work. Because the reason that we hurt other people is that we feel the need to prove our masculinity and our dominance over others. So, you know, and the same way we approach Trump, it's so often to put down his masculinity as a way of proving our own, as if, you know, and some people say, well, that's the game Trump plays, and so that's the only thing he'll listen to. But in fact, when you play that game, you play into the hierarchy of masculinity game. And so, like,
he's always going to be more patriarchally entrenched than anyone who would run as his opponent in this election. There's everybody knows, like the biggest problem is that, of course, Trump supporters know that. And to them, he is a real man. So if that becomes the undercurrent, I, I'm already, Natasha Vienna posted a great meme the other day, and I forgot to ask her where she got it, so I don't know where it originated, but it's made to look like a campaign, you know, poster, but it's Giant Meteor 2020, just ended already, and like the dark humor is starting already,
yeah.
But, boy, that is, I might just go on vacation for all of February through November next year if that's going to, because that would be the campaign we'd all be like subjected to. So that of course, because your work sets itself up so beautifully for transitions, it's so nice. I feel less choppy prepping interviews for you. All of this centering of cis straight men and the idea of good versus bad and toxic versus good masculinity, which I really, really encourage people to go back and listen to your previous spots on the show. You did do such a beautiful job in long form describing why that is so toxic and why it's so harmful to people of all genders. This centering of cis straight men and their role, like, just rolls right over into fatherhood. And I pulled your where is the title? I have it. There we go. Your piece at BuzzFeed, how traditional ideas about the ideal father can mask abuse. From R. Kelly to Michael Jackson, men accused of preying on children often use idealized versions of fatherhood to maintain their innocence and hide their abuse. People should go read the whole thing. Always read all of the things. I had seen your, Patreon post titled, What Does Father Know Best? And was like really excited to read it because like you, I get really testy when cis straight white dudes, who are largely responsible for society wide problems claim that they're the only ones who can fix those problems. So who is Terry Crews? And why were you pushing back on his proclamations about the importance of fatherhood? And then we'll dive into your very apt, well done comparison.
Yeah, you know, this is a couple months ago now, but Terry Crews, you know, was a former NFL football player, also an actor, who's on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think, and a couple other things. He's on commercials and stuff. But, you know, he's become very important in many ways to the current conversation about gender-based violence and sexual assault because he's one of the few famous, or at least pretty famous, men, and on top of that, a black man, who's admitted to being a victim or a survivor himself. So he told us a story on Twitter now, I think it was 2 years ago, where he recounted being assaulted by a white agent in Hollywood and the way in which that person wielded their power over him to kind of assume that he would never talk about it. And so he came out with this story when people were challenging some other women on their stories being shared through Me Too. And he kind of came out with his story just to show that, you know, there were many reasons why someone wouldn't talk about their assault for many years, you know, and he gave himself as an example. And it was really powerful because unfortunately we live in a patriarchal world where people don't listen to women and people of marginalized genders. And so to see someone who in many ways fits certain ideals of masculinity to openly talk about his own vulnerability, it made him kind of a hero in many ways. And you know, rightfully so, he gave this moving testimony during the, there was a hearing on a sexual assault survivor's Bill of Rights. And, you know, and so in many ways, Terry Crews has been a leading voice of Me Too. I think he was in a Time 100 or something like that.
Especially because like in so much as we don't believe women, we definitely don't believe men or masculine presenting, people with masculine presenting genders, when they if they even feel like they can talk about being sexually assaulted, because being the victim of sexual assault is in itself a, is seen as a, you know, a remark on their own masculinity. So
right.
just talking about it having happened, yeah. at all is pretty risky. Especially for someone who plays, like, you know, he plays a cop in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and, like, he's, you know, has been a professional football player, right? There's all the, he has, excuse me, primarily existed in very masculine spaces. Like, I can't even yeah. imagine how hard that was to say, not just out loud, but in front of elected officials and cameras, for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, and I will say that, you know, him, he's also, because he's Black, you know, he in many ways fulfills, people see him in a stereotypical way as like this hyper sexualized, hyper masculine Black man. You know, he has a lot of muscles, and he even plays on that character often on, like, he was in a Old Spice, series of Old Spice commercials where he, yeah. I remember he was playing yes. on that trope of, like, you know, and so that makes it extra impactful for him to say, yeah, even I got violated. But in fact, you should stop assuming that Black men are just not vulnerable at all. Or as we often see, like, police officers will report thinking that Black men and Black boys are, like, unhuman or something. So it was in so many ways a very important and powerful moment. And one of the things that happened, though, is, like, you know, I think, you know, victims are, or sorry, I should say, survivors exist across society in every mm-hmm. kind of place. You know, doesn't matter what your politics are, or where you live, or what your identity is, there are survivors there. And so, yeah, I think Terry Crews was kind of, for good reason, became a leader in this movement. But I think he doesn't always have viewpoints that necessarily everybody who else is a leader agrees with, but that happens across genders too. We know that, like, you know, the white women in Hollywood who were running Time's Up have run into controversies or disagreements amongst other people. So anyways, one of those things happened a few months ago where Terry Crews was talking about fatherhood. And in fact, it's an opinion he had shared a couple years before on The View as well. But, you know, he has a traditional view of fatherhood in our patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. And so
it's pretty biblical. I looked at yeah. his Twitter ID, and he's very grounded in the Judeo-Christian, you know, very Old Testament style of fatherhood, which
yeah.
part of why I wanted to sort of introduce him that way and sort of an imperfect another reminder, especially for us on the left, that we can call people in for these things, like the situation you're about to describe, while still appreciating the work that someone does, and also valuing them as survivors in the same way. You know, while our faves are problematic, is often seen from the critical view, we have to remember that, like, that's just true because they're people. So thanks for letting us do that little
yeah, for
in
sure.
the middle. Yes, he definitely has that very, like, I am the dad, like, the dad feel to him. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's what you said is so important, though, because of the fact that one of the And I tried in this piece I wrote to not really focus so much on, you know, Terry Crews, but rather use kind of this as a jumping off point to have another conversation, because I think what's so interesting and impactful about what Terry Crews has talked about, he has talked about not only his incident in which he was assaulted, but he's been able to expand on that to talk about masculinity more broadly, and even talked about his own relationship to his parents and his father. And he's talked about how, and in that Senate testimony around the Sexual Assault Survivors Bill of Rights, he talked about how his father abused his mom, and that he learned over time, not that once he became a dad and had a family that, you know, it would be so easy for him to become like his dad, and that he had to challenge that in him. And he names, even, which again, something that like Biden types never do, is he named that, you know, he thought of himself as more worthy than women, and that, you know, he was socialized with this thing. And so to be able to have that kind of self-reflection is really great. And so that's why, to come from that standpoint, and then it gives us a way of talking about how deeply entrenched some social ideas are that, you know, about who should be in power and who should not, that even people who are, you know, really thinking about this and talking about it can sometimes say things or think things that are actually playing into the very systems they're trying to break down. You know, and so I thought that the Terry Crews situation was a good one because, you know, he, you know, came out very strongly for fatherhood as a thing that needs to be protected, and also, you know, really as a, in, almost like an institution that's being attacked or being taken away, you know. And, you know, and the connection I made in this article is not one, again, about Terry Crews personally. It's that idea that we have in our culture that that fatherhood is just an essential thing about all of our lives that we need in our lives. You know, we need a father figure. We need somebody to teach us how to be men, or if we're not being raised to be men, we need someone to teach us how other men should be, you know, like that. There has to be a father figure. And
yeah, there are PSA style billboards all over my city that just take that. They're not put together like propaganda because it's taken as an assumed assumption, right, that, you know, fatherless children and et cetera, right? Like spin off from there, right?
Yeah.
As though somehow boys can't learn to be men and girls can't learn to be women without, like, it's, that's one of those where, like, at that point, then the argument has always broken down for me. It's like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, oh, all right.
And it's like, you know, nowadays we probably think it's absurd, like this, like the show Father Knows Best. We wouldn't, if it was on TV now, it would be like a tongue in cheek. Like, there are shows like that, like King of Queens or whatever, like, where, you know, it's the father's often bumbling now and like he doesn't know anything, but then it comes around at the end. The show's really about, yeah, but what would I do without my dad? You know, like, or, you know, yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, hating on dads. I think people who are, you know, who identify as men, who are raising children, are doing great stuff. But some people have two fathers, you know, and I think another thing about the way fatherhood is presented, it's often, you know, pretty homophobic in the way that it's in conjunction with, or, you know, and Crews said himself also in his tweets about mothers are needed too. But the point is, you know, this cultural idea that exists that we have to have fathers can then be exploited by people in power who are men who want to hurt people or who want to gain their trust in order to hurt them. And that's something that I saw in a couple of, you know, recent documentaries, like the one about R. Kelly, which is like one of the most horrifying.
I can't watch it. Like, I haven't been able to watch it. I don't fancy myself like as though I would have been at risk for being one of his victims. But like when they did one of a couple of the sets of search warrants that were presented, like the location that got all of the attention on the news, my last condo in Chicago, where I lived for 3 years, is like around the corner there. And I just like, it just is one of those that I'm like, ah, and I know like it would be, I know some of the people that were in it and like, I wanted to watch it, and then I just have not been in a place where I could do it. You do a really kick-ass job of summarizing the background, as usual, before you dove into the nitty gritty. And I'm sure that like, I'm going to guess like, with the age group of, the age category of most of my listeners, we largely know what happened with Michael Jackson, or did or didn't, or was alleged to, et cetera, et cetera. But I appreciated this part because I hadn't, Like, I just had decided mentally that R. Kelly was a garbage person, and so, like, I didn't, read it didn't need more convincing, so I wasn't reading a ton about it. You wrote, the two new documentaries contributing to the current cultural conversation about assault and abuse also deal with the themes of masculinity, fatherhood, and power. Surviving R. Kelly and Leaving Neverland spotlight how singers R. Kelly and Michael Jackson allegedly abused and sexually assaulted young girls and boys respectively throughout their careers. Based on the accounts of the survivors featured, both men are shown as obsessed with performances of masculinity rooted in control, from the casual demeaning of women to forcing kids to watch pornography. And explain a little bit more about what ties these two men together and how they were exerting control over the youth in their lives.
Yeah. You know, and I think, of course, it goes without saying that these are, everyone we're talking about right now are Black men, you know, and I think there's another thing I think we'll talk about in a minute about perceptions of Black fatherhood in particular, and the idea of like missing Black dads and the impact on society. So, you know, but before I go into all that, but what connects them beyond that, they're also both musicians, obviously, but they were both at one point, like really the most powerful or one of the most powerful people in their field. And so there were a lot of young, vulnerable folks of all genders who were around them looking for opportunities, looking up to them, looking for ways of either making it in the same industry as musicians or in other industries. And both of these people used that position to lure really young people into situations which they thought were about their careers or about, you know, even in some cases about friendship or about, you know, mentorship. But in fact, were ways, slowly became ways for those men, meaning R. Kelly and Michael Jackson, to feel a type of power that perhaps they weren't getting enough of in other ways. And so in the case of R. Kelly, you know, we know that multiple girls and women were ultimately kind of forced to stay in homes with him or, in, you know, kind of kept as his servants in some cases, you know, had all kinds of tasks and things that that he would make them do. But sometimes, you know, it'd be as simple, and I should say it's not simple, but it's common, as, you know, saying, calling them names, you know, using gendered words or, you know, hateful words to demean them. And those things, you can draw a line from them to his need to then, you know, keep them, you know, restrict them from when they could eat, you know, keep them in inside at all times, those kinds of things. And on the flip side, you know, while Michael Jackson was not necessarily doing the same things, what the documentary at least shows, two men claiming that he did, is that when they were young boys, he lured them into relationships which they thought were friendships or mentorships, but then would use those relationships, and in some one case, you know, they claim that he would make them watch pornography. But the idea there is, again, you know, for Michael Jackson, it is still in a similar way, even with different behavior, about exerting control over those who are weaker, you know, because, you know, it's no coincidence that the victims and the survivors that they chose are people who really had no power to challenge them, you know, and the way, and, you know, I don't want to go into too many more specifics, but like the language that they both used also in convincing people to come into these relationships was again rooted in similar ideas of who should be in power and who should not. So on one hand, it's definitely sexist in the sense of like, it should be men and not women, but then even more like, specifically, they would use language related to fatherhood. So, like, you see that, you know, R. Kelly would make people call him daddy, you know, all the time.
Yeah. That was, like, the biggest cringe moment for me. Yeah. I was like, especially because he clearly has a, I'm just going to use the most neutral word I can muster here, a predilection for younger women, even when he wasn't three times their age, right? Like, he married, you know, Leo was definitely not of age, right, et cetera, et cetera. And so adding, like, I have a hard time describing why it makes me so uncomfortable without being inherently kink-shaming about it, which I do not mean to be, but, like, there's, I guess it's because we know that he has crossed really specific lines, right? And so that part right there, it's the, if you have not given someone permission to consider themselves to be in a daddy role with you, it is probably the most controlling request I can imagine, like from a how you are to address me standpoint.
Yeah. And you know, it's so much of that is like, because we know what that means, you know, like, and that's kind of what this whole thing is really about, is that we both give like respect fathers, but what does that really mean? We give fathers power, you know, almost absolute power. And so, you know, R. Kelly knows what he's doing when he's asking someone, but not really asking them, making them call him that. And I think also this is you did such a great job of framing this in the sense that we talked about earlier, you know, gender-based violence overall, because I think about, this is an example of, you know, that extreme where we actually have a videotape of R. Kelly doing the thing, like abusing young girls. We know that he did it, and yet he got away with that. And that's because in a court of law, he made the argument that, you know, that you can make in courts of law that it didn't happen, you know, or that there was too many other factors to, that it wasn't him, you know, all these kinds of things. But point being, I got a little sidetracked there, but, you know, I think that the reason it can, we know that it's so uncomfortable is partially because we know that the power we give to dads. And I think that's what I was trying to look at here, is that like what it really means to be not just a dad. I mean, if we really think about it, like a good dad, like a good father, meaning the ideal father historically and is still seen in media, is someone who has all, he knows everything, like literally still, like it's like dad is the one who saves the day, is the one who can come in and solve any problem. And that's still the ideal father on TV. So even when we see the bumbling father, he's still going to save the day at the end.
Right. He pulls it together because that's what, and largely because that's what his role requires.
Yes, exactly.
Like he has to do that. I mean, that's definitely, I'm so sorry for the person that this invokes, but like my dad was definitely the decider, in family quarrels, in a weird, it's a sort of no wonder I got like very mixed, like gender role, messages from my adoptive parents, but like, my mom was definitely the more controlling one. Like we typically did things she wanted to do, like all of that. But in a moment, my dad's like, if my dad put his foot down, right? Even that phrase, like if he put his foot down, whatever was happening had to cease.
Yep.
That like he had it in his power to hit the stop button on anything that was happening in the house, clearly in his house.
Yeah. And you know, and as much as we maybe have moved away from, in some ways we might not say this openly anymore, but it's still definitely in our culture, pop culture, that like a good dad is authoritarian. And it's like, you know, one example I used here is like the Taken series, where you have like, you know, Liam Neeson is the best dad imaginable because he'll get revenge for his daughter, meaning he'll kill a bunch of other people, which is, you know, an expression of his love for his daughter, you know, which he apparently, you know, couldn't express before, you know. But often it's the story of masculinity, like overall, that like men can't express their emotions, so they need to be in roles where they can show you their love. But that's what a dad role that we've conceived, like in pop culture, is dad can't really tell me that he loves me. He's going to show me that he loves me by, you know, telling me what to do, yelling at me, maybe
threatening my boyfriend when he shows up at the door,
exactly.
Pulling him aside for the little talk,
Exactly.
Where he just shows him his gun collection. Yeah, good times.
And it's such a weird thing where that type of role is associated with not innocence necessarily, but like being good. Because, you know, one of the things that R. Kelly did during that whole debacle, which was his attempt to respond to this documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, which, by the way, is produced by Dreamhampton. I think you can still watch it somewhere.
Yes, I'll find a link and include it for people.
You know, he was on TV, and I mentioned this in the article, but like one of the things he did is he actually, in his like incoherent attempt to defend himself, at one point invoked his role as a father, where he said that
you
know, people were trying, he said something like, you know, I'm trying to maintain my relationship with my kids. It's not about music. And, you know, and he was angry, you know, and he was like demanding that role. But like for some people that was impactful, you know, and I think it that's because we have that perception that, oh yeah, well, I'll, you know, that's the best thing you could do as a man is be a father, you know, and I think there's a lot of racialized components here as well, or racist components where like, especially for black men who we don't expect to be good fathers, if they show up in that role,
yeah,
there's a lot of weight given to that. And then again, another thing I talk about in the article, because I think it's really important to note that is a whole total myth, the idea that of an absent black dads. In fact, black fathers are, you know, reported to be the most active fathers, you know, in our country. So like, that's a racist myth, but it does play into then on the reverse end, a thing that some people can exploit. And then we should also say there are like white people, tons of white dads who are doing all this stuff. And even, you know, in our most recent history, you could write the same article about Larry Nassar, you know, who used his role as a father figure to abuse dozens of gymnasts. And, you know, there's another documentary I briefly mentioned here called Abducted in Plain Sight, which, you know, is on Netflix, also terrifying, but is a white guy using the perception of a kind of a father figure to convince a friend to let their daughter, you know, sleep in the same room with him. And like, you know,
Had a really close parallel to the Michael Jackson situation for me. That documentary is really well put together. All the content notes are pretty obvious just by like reading the paragraph description. So if folks are watching for triggers, just read the paragraph description. And if you feel like nope, then probably nope. But it's put together in a very well done slow reveal over the course, and you really like you hear from the parents like why things were allowed, and sleepovers and trips and all of that sort of thing. You know, they call into his like, you know, his fatherhood and all of that stuff. Like they talk about like the perceptions of him in the community, etc. And you know, my first cassette tape that I bought with my very own money for doing my chores was Thriller. And the perception of Michael Jackson, you know, after he built Neverland, that he's just a big kid and he's harmless and he just, you know, he understands what kids need because he was a neglected kid and et cetera, et cetera. Like, parents didn't just trust him because he had a lot of money. They trusted him because of his perception, like the perception we had of him at the time and like who he was, much like that documentary. And it very definitely put kids in danger. And even, I mean, I'm prone to believe survivors as it is, but like even if the allegations, the many, many allegations about him weren't true, they certainly could be like that is a situation that could happen and should still be, you know, not in a blame the parents or blame the kids way, but like, it is something that like parents should be wary of, that are sort of, as we were talking about at the beginning, you know, when we have these really extreme polarized ideas of what constitutes bad behavior, it certainly allows for us to read people as more good than they are, as long as they don't read as completely terrible. And that's a dangerous lens through which to look at things.
Yeah, and it also, you know, kind of makes me think about, you know, the standard or the bar is so low for men to be, like, particularly straight cis men, to, you know, to impress us or to show, like, that they're different or better than the norm, because the norm is terrifying.
Yeah.
And we don't often name that. We don't name that the norm for men is just terrifying. So, you know, the bar is so low that, you know, we want to believe these things about men too. And fatherhood is one way in which we, you know, we're there's a path there for men to impress us. And it doesn't take much, you know, it's like show some interest in kids and
babysit,
you know,
your kids.
Yeah.
And well, you can't babysit your kids. It's just parenting. Like it's,
yeah, yeah, exactly. That,
I can babysit your kids because they're not my kids.
And in so many ways, Michael Jackson, you know, and I grew up idolizing Michael Jackson as well, but like, Michael Jackson was well beyond that low bar in our cultural perception because he was seen as somebody who really liked children, who was a child himself, in some ways was often infantilized in that way. But, you know, he was perceived as being someone who, you know, cared and that kind of, you know, and I say it's not just Michael Jackson. So many different men find different ways of portraying themselves as being totally different. Just like we've been talking about this whole time, it's like that was one path for Michael Jackson to be in a further position of power amongst other men, you know, because he was seen as being safe, you know. And so even in reality, though, you know, I think in watching the documentary, it really highlights for me, or at least it highlighted that that perception was partially media created, but part of it is a reflection of the society we live in. Because if you go back and watch everything, it's like it was right there in front of us.
Yeah.
And we chose to believe something about him that he wasn't even always saying. Sometimes he was literally letting us see him do things that should have been red flags and that were to many people. But
not nearly enough of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's part of why I really appreciate your work and enjoy your, not just your expertise, but the way in which you weave those things together. Because while I don't hope that my show terrifies people, I like to think that if we don't know what red flags to look for around us, that we're more likely to be subjected to them and to allow them to play out in our own lives and our own behavior. And so I know that my listeners are good internal critics, and we like to push ourselves to be uncomfortable long enough to learn. And so I really, really appreciate your time. There's never enough time. We could talk about this all day. Everyone has to go subscribe to Iman's Patreon, follow them on Twitter, follow the work at the Center for Media Justice, and for heaven's sakes, remind me if I ever let this much time pass before having them back on the show. Iman, thank you again so much for making time and for the tireless work holding our culture to the highest of standards.
Thank you so much. This was awesome. I'm always down to talk about this stuff with you, so thanks for having me.
This has been the Katie Speaks Show. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks again to Imran Siddiqui for stopping by and sticking around, as always. And thanks, of course, to Netroots Radio for the opportunity to show up here every week and say what I think, unedited and unrestrained. Should something you heard in the show made you consider a new perspective or want to learn more about an issue, links to articles and guests are included in the episode notes at katiespeak.com. While you're there, let me know about voices you want to hear from and issues you want to hear about. You can also find me on Twitter and across social media at Katie_speak, or leave a comment on the show's Patreon page. The Katie Speaks Show is free and available to all. If you're able, consider supporting my broadcasting and other culture change work for as little as $1 a month through the Patreon website at patreon.com/Katie_speak or make a one-time contribution at paypal.me/KatieSpeak_. Never forget that culture change is a long fight, and we need you in it. So as always, take this advice from Audre Lorde. Caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. Rest up, we have work to do.
If the answer's no, you can tell me so, 'cause I won't be offended. You're pretty cool, and my ultimate hope is that our friendship won't get suspended. Just let me know before I go if there's something fun that we can do. Because I'm not dead yet, and neither are you. That's right, I said I'm not dead yet, and neither are you. One more time, good measure.